Now, there's also a really interesting finding with the McDonald's screens, which I hear anecdotally, which is since the screens came in, far more people order unusual meals. In particular, more men order meals which contain two burgers, even though it's just them eating.
That is Rory Sutherland. He is the vice chairman of Ogilvy UK, the author of the Popular Spectator column The Wiki Man, and the best-selling book Alchemy. He is arguably the world's best-known behavioural science practitioner, and he certainly has some of the most forward-thinking suggestions on how to apply behavioural science. Today, we get into all of that. Rory shares how attitudes don't form behaviour, how McDonald's got blokes to buy two burgers rather than one, and his hot take on reforming pensions. All of that coming up. The podcast I'd like to recommend today is the D2C Pod, brought to you by the HubSpot Podcast Network, the audio destination for business professionals. The D2C Pod is a podcast all about all the things direct to consumer. The hosts cover everything from starting, growing, and optimizing e-commerce stores and D2C brands. If you're interested in the stories behind your favorite consumer brands, this is a podcast for you. To start, I'd suggest checking out episode 318, which features the CMO of Feastables. So, listen to D2C Pod wherever you get your podcasts. There is a common belief that attitudes lead to behaviours, that points of view dictate actions. For example, if someone likes F1, they'll be more likely to drive to work. But behavioural scientists like Rory argue that the opposite might be true.
Well, very frequently, it works in reverse, that you change people's behavior and their attitudes then to avoid kind of cognitive dissonance, their attitudes then come to align with their behavior. In other words, we often post-rationalize our attitudes in many ways. Okay. And that would be particularly applicable, I think, with things like environmental behavior, which is that I don't think many people buying a Tesla principally bought it because it was environmentally friendly. I think they bought it because they were geeks and they really liked the car. Okay. Having bought an electric car myself for largely selfish reasons, I don't think I could go back to a petrol car. In fact, the extent of the aversion to petrol once you've driven electric was manifested by the fact that I actually had 7 days in Italy earlier this year. And I actually went to some lengths to rent an electric car, which was an act of slightly bravado, actually, because I wasn't sure what the charging infrastructure was like. In the event, it was pretty good. I think an awful lot of things work that way. We had an advertising campaign, which was an ad campaign, but it was under the line of one bin is rubbish. And we realized that if people have two bins, they will tend to separate out recyclables from non-recyclables much more reliably than people who have one bin, who, you know, with the best will in the world, you know, it's late, it's 11 o'clock at night. Ah, fuck it. You know, okay, you know. And, you know, my argument would be that in that case, you know, a Jeremy Clarkson with two bins will be better at recycling than a Greta Thunberg with one bin. That actually, in many cases, our behaviour is a product of our environment, not our intention or our attitude. And that is a known bias in the behavioural science, which is kind of intentionality bias, that it's apparently particularly acute in the West. I didn't realise this. But in Eastern cultures, they are more likely to explain people's behaviour in terms of the context in which they found themselves. Whereas in Western cultures, could it be a legacy of Christianity, perhaps, or just Western religions? We're more likely to say they did that because they're a bad person, not because they found themselves in circumstances where, you know, they are weak-willed, they are evil, they're selfish, whatever it may be. And so understanding the context and understanding essentially the context in which decisions are made and therefore in which behaviours originate strikes me as an essential part of the jigsaw to solve. Regardless of the role that attitude plays, you have to look at this because it's a nonsense just to assume that an attitudinal change leads directly to behavioural change. It's simply not reliable.
Rory makes the point that most Tesla owners probably weren't strong environmentalists before buying. But since buying, because of that behaviour, they've formed stronger views on the environment.
A few years ago, I'd happily drink instant coffee. I didn't care about coffee quality. But since joining a fully remote company in 2020, I started to spend more time in cafes, working from these cafes and drinking fancy coffee. Now, my attitude has changed. I don't buy instant coffee. In fact, I'd never drink it. I'd love to tell myself that's because of my mature tastes, that I appreciate the delicate flavours of an oat flat white, but that's bullshit. My attitude changed because my behaviour changed. I fell out of love with instant coffee because I was spending much of my working day drinking barista-poured coffee and chatting with coffee experts. Behaviours form attitudes, and Rory's got a great example of this in practice. Before McDonald's introduced touchscreen ordering, customers bought predictable items like Big Mac meals and Egg McMuffins. But once the touchscreens came in, all that changed.
The McDonald's screens are, the speed with which they rolled them out, I think, is evidence of their efficacy. If you want to sell as much as possible, give people a choice of interfaces. One thing I will make a point of here is what McDonald's has not done is replaced human order takers with screens completely. They have given the consumer a choice. Okay, obviously the hourly cost of a screen is lower than the hourly cost of an employee, but McDonald's has not done what a lot of companies will do, I think, which is a terrible mistake, which is to replace a human interface with an exclusively automated interface. What they've done is actually they've gone effectively multi-channel. In other words, in fact, very, very, very multi-channel, because you can, as well as using a screen, you can actually pre-order on your mobile phone, you can order on a tablet, etc. And general, I wouldn't say it's an absolutely unfailing rule, but most of the time, the more ways you give people a mode of buying something, the more people buy. Okay. Now, there's also a really interesting finding with the screens, which I hear anecdotally, which is since the screens came in, far more people order unusual meals. In particular, more men order meals which contain two burgers, even though it's just them eating. What's quite interesting about that is there was probably an element of social embarrassment or not wanting to look weird or not wanting to create a double take, which caused people to order more conventionally face to face because they didn't want to go going, but so you want two burgers, but only one fries. I don't get that. Don't you want a meal with both of them? And then you'd have to go, well, it's just for me. And they go, God, you lard ass. Okay, right. So fundamentally changing the interface changes the behavior. That's why Amazon, is one of the most valuable companies in the world, because, they are a kind of default interface for people who want to buy shit who aren't in a shop currently. And let's face it, there's no point in attitudinal change unless it leads to behavioural change somewhere, not necessarily in the person whose attitude changes necessarily. But, obviously the purpose of some activity is to change the decisions, how people act in some way. What this does is, it stops people going, the attitude is what needs to be changed in order to change the behavior, and forces it to you to look at the question both holistically, i.e. what part is attitude playing in this behavior and what part is the wider environment. It also forces you to factor in time, okay? Because the general approach of advertising was we change people's attitude and then their behavior changes and we just do a big ad campaign. But there are moments at which you can intervene which are probably 10 times more potent than other moments. And so it also forces you to think about the customer journey, or in the case of public sector work, the decision maker journey, and to look at the various points along that line. Not that it's ever that linear, by the way, but you can look at the points of maximum leverage there. And that means you target by time, not by audience. In other words, you have a target moment, not a target audience, which is also enriching in terms of the possibility of finding breakthrough and creative solutions.
Rory says that there are moments you can intervene that are 10 times more potent than other moments. This resonated. I came across compelling evidence to back this up when reading Chip and Dan Heath's book, The Power of Moments. The authors cite a study by Adam Grant of Wharton University on initiation for local lifeguards. See, Adam Grant noted how lifeguards with a few years in the job will often share their best stories of bravery, of how lifeguards have rescued drowning swimmers. These stories, they drew lifeguards together. It bonded them. It gave them a sense of meaning. Adam was sure that if new lifeguards heard these stories far earlier in their careers, they'd be more committed. So he tested it. At a community recreation centre in the Midwest, Grant divided 32 new lifeguards into two groups. The control group heard the standard typical information. It was about how other lifeguards had benefited down the road from skills they had acquired on the job, the typical thing they hear in onboarding. The others heard stories of lifeguards rescuing drowning swimmers. Adam Grant then monitored each of the group's commitment over the following months. The group of lifeguards who heard the brave stories about lifeguards saving swimmers, well, they voluntarily signed up to 43% more hours of work in the following weeks than the control group. Just one 30-minute session changed their behaviour. By sharing these stories early in the lifeguard's career, they became more committed. This showcases Rory's point that there are some moments that are more potent than others. So that's the power of moments. But going back to the McDonald's story, Rory had another point to make. See, it's not just moments that change behaviour. Rory thinks interfaces are just as important. Here's why.
Let's imagine you received a $30,000 or £30,000 windfall from an elderly aunt who died. Now, you're probably a bit younger. You probably wouldn't do this. I'm 58, okay? The most logical thing to do would be to pay that into my pension. But I probably wouldn't. Why not? Well, two reasons. It wouldn't occur to me. Okay, I don't know why it wouldn't occur to me, but it wouldn't. Now, you might argue that's partly an attitudinal thing. But I think it's also very largely an interface question, which is that if I want to put money into my deposit account with my bank, which currently pays me some absolutely crock of shit rate of interest, incidentally, and doesn't have any tax advantages, I can do that on the app. Okay. If I want to pay money into my pension, I'm not making this up, I'd actually have to write a check. I don't know where my checkbook is. I'd have to post it off to an address I don't know. Worse still, I would send them this check, by the way, and they wouldn't send a text to acknowledge it and say, oh, by the way, we received your £30,000 with the tax rebate. That means you get an extra £45,000 in your pension. And whoop-de-doo, isn't that great? We've received the money. Didn't you do well? No, nothing happens. I'd have to remember that I'd paid that money in. Spend 6 months in a state of mild anxiety, then check my pension statement to check they'd actually received it and credited me correctly at the end of the year. Okay. Now, there are two problems with that, one of which is a massive pain in the ass. And by the way, okay, I spoke to a pensions company about that, and one of the people who worked for the pensions company had exactly this problem, which is they'd written a check in and then they'd been failed to be credited adequately or to be credited to the wrong account. And that involved like 24 hours of work on their part. Okay. When I move money to my deposit account, it's instant gratification. When I move money to my pension account, it's really, really deferred gratification combined with a huge heap of uncertainty and anxiety. Okay, no surprise I put the money in my deposit account. But there's another problem, which is that if something's difficult to do, it makes us nervous. As well as making us frustrated, it makes us nervous because we go, if this were a normal thing to do, someone would have made it easy, right? We naturally feel I'm going off piste here by doing this because I'm writing a bloody check. You know, I feel like a character in a sort of Dickens drama. I'm writing this check with a bloody pen. Okay, this is weird and ridiculous. Therefore, maybe I shouldn't be doing this at all. It's a natural kind of human inference or heuristic, you know, that, you know, if lots of people do something, it's probably okay. And I'm then doing a second order heuristic, which is, well, if lots of people do this, wouldn't they have made it a bit easier? They obviously haven't. Now, this is a few years out of date now, but about 6 years ago, I also asked an audience of people who worked in financial services, if I gave them £1,000 and told them you can keep that provided you've paid it into your pension before the end, before you get home this evening, how many of you would know how to do that? One person put up their hand. They worked for Goldman Sachs. Okay. Now, that's shit. Okay, that's just terrible. Before we start doing an advertising campaign going whoop-de-doop, aren't pensions amazing? The second thing is the pension is a case where the government gives you money, a lot of money. You get money from the government, right? Now, why governments confine their best tax breaks to people late in life who are already probably relatively wealthy, when I really needed these tax breaks when I had two kids and I was 35 years old. I don't need them now, I'm 58. The little buggers are about to become kind of self-sustaining, I hope, although one of them studying philosophy, so my hopes of that are, you know, should we say, realistic. Okay, slightly dampens your hopes of finding a job in the Goldman Sachs graduate pool, but nonetheless, okay, you the government gives you money. Now, if you give someone money, okay, when you give someone a present, you wrap it in paper, right? And you say, it's a present, okay? You don't just go, oh, yeah, by the way, I've left a case of champagne on the back of your car, unless you're engaged in some dodgy dealing. Yet the government gives you this money for your pension with absolutely no fanfare or razzmatazz whatsoever. There's not a text to say your pension's just been boosted. In fact, you wouldn't even know you were getting this bloody tax break unless you're like anally retentive and check your pension balance every month. Are these people nuts? I mean, it's like the old joke is it's like pissing yourself in a dark suit. You get a nice warm feeling, but no one else notices. Right, okay. Why would you do that? I have no screaming idea, except that the people who work in government who decide these things are bloody tragic accountants who think that marketing is unimportant or indeed evil or distracting, and that provided you create the economic conditions for rational behaviour, that people will consequently behave rationally.
In April 2020, Donald Trump insisted on signing his name on the federal government handout to support citizens. This one-time direct cash payment of $1,200 per person plus $500 per child wasn't an invisible benefit like Rory's pension rebates. It was a check received in the post with Trump's signature on it. Now, this caused much backlash. Senior IRS officials lamented that taxes are supposed to be non-political. But putting all that aside, this did achieve something that all too many governments fail at. It made the financial assistance governments provide feel real and tangible. Rather than a 2-point cut to national insurance, which most Brits struggle to actually conceptualise, let alone calculate how much it'll save, the government would achieve far more appreciation if it sent a direct bank transfer, along with an email or push notification to every phone explaining the benefit. It's a great idea from Rory, but it's not the only one he has. He's not done on taxes. After the break, he'll share one simple tax change that he reckons will make high earners much more willing to pay.
Finding a service solution that helps you better connect with customers and keep them happy can feel impossible. It's like trying to remember the name of someone you've just met at a networking event. I've made this mistake before, introducing a colleague to my new friend Dan, only to find out his name was actually Ian. Being personal with your customers is important, but keeping on top of all that information can be very hard. That's where HubSpot's all-new Service Hub comes in. It brings service and success together on one powerful platform for the first time ever. It's got an AI-powered help desk and an AI-powered chatbot that handles frontline tickets fast. Plus, it comes with a customer success workspace that helps reps anticipate customer needs. Plus, it never forgets a first name. All of that can help you scale support and drive retention and revenue. That means better service and happier customers at every stage of the journey. Visit hubspot.com/service to do more for your customers today.
Okay, welcome back to Nudge. You're listening to me, Phil Agnew, and Rory Sutherland. On the subject of taxes, Rory has some simple suggestions, one which he thinks will make high earners far happier to pay.
I'll make 2 points about taxes. What should the top rate of tax be in the UK? Okay. The purpose of tax is to maximise revenue collection while minimising avoidance or reluctance to work as a consequence. If you asked anybody who'd worked in retail, they'd tell you that the top rate of tax should be 39.9%. Okay, right. It shouldn't be 40%. Do not make the top rate of tax 40%. You could knock 0.1% off that and get a huge basic feeling of, that's better. Okay, right. For God's sake, retail's known this for 100 flaming years. Okay, right. Okay, are you idiots? Okay, that's the first point. The second point is, for all kinds of reasons, paying a tax rebate doesn't create a new normal. It actually creates appreciation every year. Secondly, it doesn't create outrage if you withhold it. Now, had you had a tax rebate system, you could have said during COVID, because of COVID, we'll only be able to pay 30% of the usual rebate. So it gives you that's why companies pay staff in a bonus, right? It gives them a degree of flexibility to share the ups and the downs and the risk with their employees. And likewise, governments should do the same thing with their citizens. But also, a single lump sum, there's quite a lot of evidence that Americans actually deliberately overpay their taxes because they like a chunky rebate. If you're in the poorer half of the population, by which I would say probably a little below that, but if you're significantly below median income, okay, life isn't really a wealth problem, it's a cash flow problem. And one of the ways you can significantly liberate the poor is by giving them lump sums. Because there are a lot of things, let's face it, okay, our capacity, if you're not very wealthy, our capacity to save, you know, I mean, the compounding effect is amazing, but unless you're quite rich to begin with, it doesn't really get exciting for quite a long time, okay? But, okay, here's the thing. So saving is pretty unrealistic. There are a lot of things you can't do if you don't have access to 500 quid. Okay, you can't repair your car. You can't sort out the leaking thing in the roof. Okay, there are an awful lot of things you can't do if you don't have access to lump sums. There is actually bizarrely a right wing movement in the United States, which wants welfare to be paid in the shape of lump sums. And of course, you always get the argument, oh, they'll just spend it on drink, you know, da, 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 which is extremely patronizing. Okay, I mean, there will be cases who'll spend their money on drink, but they're probably spending all their money on drink anyway. Okay, I would say, okay, this is an interesting way of looking at it. But now John Reid, who is the cigarette smoking Minister of Health under the, I think, Brown administration here in the UK. He was a smoker still. He'd grown up, I think, in a working class place in Glasgow. And he kind of defended the right of the poor to smoke in a way. By saying, partly because I think he was a tabber himself, but he partly said, if you've got absolutely no money, what you need is a 50p or £1, you know, a 70p pleasure, okay? Because the £5 pleasures or the £20 pleasures aren't really accessible to you. And so, you know, one of the reasons why poor people smoke is, well, everybody needs a bit of fun in their life, and can you tell me something else that gives you that amount of pleasure for 70p? You know, Yeah, it's all very well for rich people. I don't understand why these people are spending their money on smoking. But if you're living absolutely close to the breadline, okay, well, yeah, I get it. You shouldn't smoke. But equally, you're not looking forward to your next fucking skiing holiday, are you? Right? You know, in other words, your fundamental pleasures are fundamentally constrained. And so, you know, I would argue that people in the effective altruism movement seem to have come to this sort of similar conclusion, that you just give people a short-term dollop of money and as an opportunity to sort their shit out to some extent. I think they make the argument that actually, to some extent, paying constant weekly benefits is a form of kind of Chinese water torture. It's almost like, you know, keeping someone on an intravenous drip. It doesn't really solve anything. It just keeps you dependent. It also makes people incredibly nervous about looking for work, because if one thing messes with the frequency of their benefit payments, it can be actually kind of cash flow catastrophe.
This idea to give welfare out in lump sums is interesting. It got me thinking about the principle in behavioural science known as variable rewards. Now, this is the idea that variable rewards are more motivating than consistent rewards. Evidence for this comes from a 2014 study led by Luxi Shen, a psychologist at the University of Chicago. She recruited 87 participants and set them a challenge. Some participants were incentivized with a $2 reward. This was the certain reward condition, while the others were offered a 50-50 chance of either winning $1 or $2. This is the variable reward condition. She found that when the reward was unpredictable, 70% of the participants ended up completing the task, compared to just a mere 43% in the certain reward scenario. Now, this is interesting because the reward for the certain scenario is greater, but that variability, that was the thing that encouraged action. To Rory's point, perhaps variable lump sums would be far more motivating than consistent yet small welfare payments. Look, it's pretty clear that Rory's got a few gripes about economists. And seeing that he was on a roll, I decided to ask him what the worst thing about modern economics is.
Well, that's difficult. It's a very, very crowded field for the worst thing to come out of neoliberal economics. But one of the worst things is the single representative agent, right? Because, okay, let's take it. Okay, yes, on average, increasing the tax on cigarettes reduces smoking. Okay, great. Okay. What about the people who can't quit, who are poor? It could be destroying their household. Okay. And you're looking at a very, very narrow interpretation of that data.
Now, just in case you, like me, needed a refresher on what the single representative agent is, then don't worry, I've Googled it. It is a term used by economists to refer to the typical decision maker. Economists make decisions to benefit the single representative agent. In other words, to benefit the average person. But like Rory mentions, the issue with this is that it leaves out people who are not average. Taxes on smoking reduces smoking on average. They reduce smoking for the single representative agent, but they'll make the lives of cash-poor addicts utterly miserable.
Second point with the single representative agent is increasing interest rates. Well, okay, maybe that like reduces inflation a bit, although given that the reason for recent inflation was actually exogenous supply chain shocks, right? It wasn't really runaway inflation inside the system. The reason to increase interest rates doesn't seem to be entirely clear, okay? Because what the government should have done is said, sort out supply chain problems and get the Russians out of Ukraine or get the oil flowing again or whatever it might be, okay? We could get the bread flowing again. Not let's put the interest rates up, because an interest rate rise is unbelievably uneven in terms of winners and losers. It's unbelievably polarizing. Okay, in the same way that smoking, putting tax on cigarettes is brilliant for the people who quit. It's a double win, isn't it? They save a fortune and they don't get cancer. Okay, but no one's asking the corresponding question. Yeah, but what about the people who, you know, there are some people, myself included, okay? I don't drink very much. I'm an incredibly moderate drinker. I think because I'm a bit fat. I think my doctors always think I'm lying, but I don't drink very much. I very rarely drink at home. I never drink alone. I basically, because I'm lazy and I like driving, I rarely have more than like two units in an evening because, you know, and then I leave it for a few hours. So I've metabolized it by the time I get home. You know, but there are some people, myself included, who find quitting nicotine almost impossible. I would take it, if I were in prison, I'd take up smoking again in a shop, right? Or, you know, I mean, if you can't get vapes, I'd smoke again in a shop. Not a moment's hesitation, okay? So, what's the effect on those people? So you have this fundamental problem, by the way, which is we're not sufficiently granular. The single representative agent causes us to solve for the average, not to solve for the individual. Now, an interesting one there. I'll give you two interesting examples here. Now, I'm going to be really careful about the second one because I'm not even sure that I want to reveal it, okay? But it is in the public domain. I just don't know where I want to put it. The first one is salt, okay? Telling people not to eat salt, on average, increases life expectancy. But it doesn't increase life expectancy for everybody. It's that there are 6 or 7% of people or whatever whose blood pressure does not effectively cope well with salt. Okay. Now, if you could identify who those people were, you could then say to those people, you need to really, really cut back on salt and stop bothering the rest of us. And we can concentrate on the people who should give up salt rather than trying to solve for the average. Okay. The single representative agent just says what's good for the average person is good for everybody. Not true. Now, it doesn't matter that much if I don't eat that much salt, because even if I'm one of those people who's not particularly susceptible to that, salt isn't particularly bad for me. Okay. What happens if you do that 6 times and you do the same thing with you mustn't eat this, you mustn't eat that, you mustn't drink coffee, you mustn't drink wine, you mustn't do that. Okay. Well, suddenly you've gone to the entire population. Instead of saying you over there, you shouldn't drink alcohol. You over there, you shouldn't eat salt. You over there, you shouldn't do this. Instead, you've gone to everybody and said the only way to be healthy is to lead a life of almost, you know, tragic, desperational boredom. Okay, right. Okay. Now, here's another one, which is a real toughie. Now, is your audience mostly fairly responsible, or do you have a kind of... Okay, I'll share it anyway. I think I will, because I think the time has come. Okay. Sir Richard Doll did the work on the link between smoking and lung cancer, and it was an absolute statistical slam dunk. The argument was absolutely conclusive. By the way, this wasn't like an increase in likelihood of, 3% or 5% or whatever. It was like in the hundreds of percent that smoking made you more likely to get lung cancer. Slam dunk. The other thing he found was that if you quit before you're 35, it looks as though your life expectancy isn't much affected. So there is a question here which asks, which is, at what point should we do a smoking campaign that says that writes to people on their 35th birthday, or better still, their 34th birthday, and says, okay, you've got a year to quit? After now, a lot of people don't quit because they think the damage has already been done. There are a lot of people in their 30s or 40s or whatever who go, there's no point in quitting now because basically, you know, I've done the damage already. And those people really need to quit because they're over 35. They're over 55. They really need to quit. There's a very, very strong reason why the first finding of Dole is very famous. Smoking causes lung cancer, which is they wanted everybody to know. Okay. There's also a very good reason why the other finding of Dole, which is quit before the age of 35 and it doesn't seem to do much long-term harm, is completely unknown because they didn't want kids to start smoking. Okay. And they didn't want kids to go, well, Dad, you can't smoke, but I've got another 10 years left. Right. Okay. And they didn't want kids to think, well, I might as well try this because I've got, you know, I've got 25 years of, not quite that young. I've got 10 years of risk-free smoking to enjoy before I had to quit. You might, however, argue that if people can switch to vaping and get off cigarettes, that youth smoking is less of a problem and smoking in the elderly should be really, well, certainly in the middle age, should be really focused on heavily, and that you might want to do a communication inflection point around people at the age of people, when people are 35, and say, okay, from now on, every cigarette counts. You dodged a bullet, but from now on, everyone counts. And then give people a reason to quit. Because one of the things we need in order to change our behavior is a narrative that we can then supply to explain to others or to ourselves why our behavior changed.
Today, Rory has looked at how a basic understanding of human psychology can change the way we answer life's tough questions. He shared irrational ways to double a bloke's McDonald's order, a simple method to make high earners more willing to pay tax, and a better time to tell people to quit smoking. It's always a pleasure to hear Rory riff on these topics, but we weren't done. Rory and I went on to discuss creativity. He told me what bees can teach us about innovation, why doormen shouldn't have been retired, and how Brexit could have been avoided. All of that is coming up in a future episode of Nudge, so to make sure you don't miss it, please do sign up to my newsletter. Not only will you be the first to hear about that future episode with Rory, but you'll also get my weekly behavioural science tip and access to bonus episodes. To sign up, just head to nudgepodcast.com and click newsletter in the menu, or just click the link in today's show notes. That's all for this week, folks. Massive thank you to Rory for coming on the show. If you haven't read his book, Alchemy, then what are you doing? It is brilliant. It tops most marketers' must-read list, and I would highly recommend it. There's a link to it in the show notes if you want to check it out. Thank you so much for listening, folks. I'll be back next week with another episode of Nudge.